This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more details, see jodcast.net.
Okay, so you're here chatting about the work that you do on pulsar timing arrays. Tell us a little bit about what a pulsar timing array is.
Okay, so a pulsar is a rotating neutron star. These are stars that spin around. They have very strong magnetic fields and out of the magnetic poles. For some reason that's not quite clear, we get these beams of radiation. Every time the pulsar spins once, we get a flash of light, and it's a bit like a lighthouse in space. And that's what we call a pulsar. So as it rotates, we get these flashes of light, which we detect using radio telescopes.
And in particular, the Parkes telescopes.
Exactly. So I'm based down in Sydney, and use most of my time, I spend about a couple of days each month out at the Parkes radio telescope. It's the only large single-dish radio telescope in the Southern Hemisphere.
Mm.
And so it does quite a lot of different types of research.
This is the one that was in the movie The Dish, was it?
It was in The Dish, and you can still buy things in the visitor centre there to say that I did not play cricket on The Dish.
Is it true in your case? Have you ever played cricket in The Dish?
I've walked around on The Dish, but I've never played cricket on it.
So what is a timing array?
Right, so the timing array project is, the aim is to detect gravitational waves. So these are waves predicted by the general theory of relativity. As big masses like big black holes move in the universe, they emit these gravitational waves. The gravitational waves come through space, and they affect the signal that we receive from various pulsars. So a timing array project is to observe a large number of pulsars all around the sky and to use the signals that we receive from those pulsars to try and detect these gravitational waves.
So explain just a little bit about what is actually waving with a gravitational wave.
That's a really hard question. It comes from a prediction of general relativity, which says that if you take a mass and you move the mass around in some asymmetric manner, then you'll get a wave in space and time. So it's a small fluctuation in basically the fabric of space and time that propagates out from the source at the speed of light, and it's that we're trying to detect.
Presumably these waves have some energy they associated with them. I mean, nothing in the universe happens just by itself, right? So these waves are being caused, as you say, by shifting masses which have gravity, and shifting them, they produce gravitational waves. So how much energy is contained in one of these waves?
Yeah, so the answer there is these waves are very, very tiny in terms of their amplitude. So gravitational waves can be very large. In fact, one wave can cover the whole universe, but the effect of the wave on us on Earth is absolutely tiny. So what would happen as one of these waves went past, let's say I had my arm out, is my arm would slowly get a bit longer, then a bit fatter, and then a bit shorter, and so on. So it would slightly affect measurements of length that we can make. The biggest problem is that the changes in the lengths are absolutely tiny. So for something that's 4 kilometers long, if a gravitational wave goes past, it will only change its size by less than an atomic nucleus. So it's very, very hard to find.
So, two questions arise from this. If you're trying to measure something getting longer, shorter as a gravitational wave goes past us, presumably we've got some kind of ruler that we're trying to measure, but won't the ruler get longer and shorter the same way? I mean, the gravitational wave affects everything it goes through, yes?
Yes, so that's absolutely true. So if you just had one ruler, you couldn't do this experiment. So on Earth, various people around the world have built what are called interferometer systems. So these are basically two rulers at 90 degrees to each other. So you send the light beam down basically 2 4-kilometer long tubes. There's a mirror at the end of the tube which reflects the light, and when the light comes back together again, you see if one of the arms is slightly longer than the other one. So as a gravitational wave would come past, it will be making one of these arms longer and shorter, and the other one will happen in a different direction. So by having two arms, you can actually detect these waves.
And there are experiments, as you say, which are going to be trying to measure gravitational waves in this way. So LIGO is one, and LISA is in the space version. So we've spoken about that in previous episodes of the Jodcast, which is good. But how do we use pulsars to do the same trick? What specifically do we use about the pulsars to measure these gravitational waves going past us?
So the problem with LIGO, which is this interferometer system on Earth, is that it's 4 kilometers long, which is quite short for what you're trying to detect. So one way of getting around this is you put your detector in space, and that's what LISA is doing, and those arms are 3 million kilometers apart from each other. But you can, of course, go one step further, and our pulsars are all the way across our own galaxy, so these are at much further distances. But we need some way of measuring how the pulsar is moving, or the space-time is changing around the pulsar compared to the Earth. But we can do that because the pulsar is a very stable clock. It sends out, it rotates in a very regular manner, sending out these pulses of radiation. And if the gravitational wave signal is affecting space-time around the Earth or the pulsar, it means the pulses will seem to be arriving at the telescope a little bit later or earlier than it would be if that gravitational wave didn't exist. So we look at lots of pulsars, and we're looking for slight variations in when the pulses are actually arriving from when we think they should be arriving, and use that to say, oh, well, they're arriving in the wrong time. Maybe it's because there's a gravitational wave affecting these arrival times.
Okay, so we've got a method now for detecting gravitational waves. What's producing these gravitational waves?
So it's most likely that these gravitational waves will be coming from merging supermassive black hole systems in the centers of galaxies. So we know that most galaxies do have big black holes in their centers, and we know that galaxies crash into each other, and these black holes probably coalesce. And during that coalescence time, they'll be emitting these gravitational waves that we should be able to detect.
Isn't there a problem, though? It's been long known that if you take two galaxies and you throw them together, generally what's colliding are not stars, the things that we can see. And a black hole, yes, is a very big object, probably at the center of each of these galaxies, but surely it's the same problem. What's the chances that you actually get a collision between the two black holes?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and it's basically unsolved. What we expect will be happening is that the two galaxies will come together, but it won't be a direct head-on collision in any sense of that. But then the black holes will be in a long period orbit around each other, but will start to kick out stars. Because they're kicking out stars, they will lose energy, and the two black holes will go towards each other. So it's called dynamical friction, which is a method of getting your two black holes, which are quite a long way away from each other, into the center next to each other. And when they're only a few light years apart from each other, then their whole emission process will be dominated by gravitational waves, and then they'll just crash into each other.
How long will it take for each of these phases of two black holes getting close to each other, roughly?
A long time. I'm not sure the numbers off the top of my head. I know anything that we might be able to detect will have an orbital period of only years to tens of years. And those will coalesce on that sort of time scale. Mm-hmm. So when it's in a gravitational wave emitting regime, it will coalesce very, very fast. But in terms of this dynamical friction to get them together, I don't think that's very well understood how long that will take.
So let's say we've got two black holes orbiting each other quite closely, so they're getting close to this final merging event. They're throwing out gravitational waves, but at what frequency?
So the frequency is proportional to the orbital period. So if the stars are going around each other in a few years, then the gravitational waves will also have a period of a few years. So the gravitational waves we're likely to see will be on timescales of months to years. Hmm. We can't see ones much longer than that because we've only been timing our pulsars on timescales of a few years. And we can't see gravitational waves on timescales much shorter than that because we only observe our pulsars once every fortnight or so.
This brings us back to the Parkes pulsar timing array. What pulses are you looking at? All of them or some of them? Which ones?
So we've chosen the 20 most stable pulsars that we can see from the Parkes telescope. So some pulsars are very irregular, they glitch, their rotation rate suddenly changes. They're just not stable objects. Whereas other pulsars are probably the most stable objects in the universe. And so we picked the most stable ones, and really there's only about 20 that are particularly useful, and it's those 20 we've chosen.
What do you expect to observe first using these 20 pulsars? Do you expect to see a gravitational wave, or do you expect to see hints of a gravitational wave? What's the first thing you're going to see with these things?
As we keep observing these 20 pulsars and we keep improving our systems for making the observations, and we just observe for longer and longer, then we'll start to see the arrival times of these pulses not being exactly when we're predicting them to be arriving. And they'll be changing by of the order 10 to 100 nanoseconds, which is the level we need to look for them. There's two types of systems that we might be seeing. There's just a single source out there. So just somewhere in the universe, there's one big binary black hole system. Then that will induce a sinusoidal signal in our timing. So for that, we'll just be looking for a sine wave with an amplitude of around this 100 nanoseconds. And that would tell us there is a single black hole system out there. And by looking at the timing of different pulsars, we'll actually better say where in the sky this is coming from. It's probably more likely that there isn't just one of these, but there's actually lots of these binary black holes. And in that case, we'll just see some random noise in our timing. And the way we were to say that this random noise is due to a gravitational wave background is looking at the timing in different pulsars and seeing if it's correlated or not.
So even though it looks like it's completely random noise, as you say, if you're looking at two pulsars at the same time, they're showing the same noise?
If the two pulsars are in the same direction, they'll almost be showing the same noise. If the two pulsars are separated by about 90 degrees, then the noise will be anti-correlated. So when one pulsar is arriving early, the other pulsar will be arriving late.
So this degree of correlation between the signals coming from two pulsars separated by a certain angle on the sky is well known. We can compute this from our understanding of general relativity.
Correct. So if you believe general relativity, you can predict that exactly. And if you have your own favorite theory of relativity, then that will also make some prediction that we can look for.
Do you need a handful of 20 pulsars to do this, or just two pulsars? How many do you need?
Well, with two pulsars, you don't get much of a study of the correlation curve. So to make a definitive detection, we've shown that you really do need at least 20 pulsars, and to do a careful study of exactly what this correlation looks like, you probably need a lot more than that.
So what's the way forward? Is it just to do the current observations longer, for a longer period of time, or do you need better accuracy, or do you need more pulsars, or is it all of the above?
All of the above. So I think the way forward is first, we get one or two of our best pulsars, and we try and improve our timing, and we keep trying to improve our timing until we can't anymore. And that's probably because there is a gravitational wave background out there that's not allowing us to improve our timing anymore. Now, it could also be due to systematic effects or anything else. So once we're at this level, we then need to prove it's a gravitational wave background. And to do that, we need about 20 pulsars at that sort of level. So somehow we'll need to combine data from the Parkes telescope with the various European telescopes and the North American telescopes to have enough pulsars where we can do that. On the longer term, we want to really study this background and understand the gravitational waves and where they're coming from and what are their properties. And to do that, we'll probably need hundreds of pulsars. And for that, we'll need a completely new telescope. The Square Kilometer Array, which is this telescope that might be built in 20 years or so, would be an absolutely ideal telescope for really studying the gravitational wave signals.
One interesting point to put all this into context is, have we actually detected any gravitational waves at all?
No.
But we know that they exist.
We know that they exist. So in the 1970s, a pulsar system was discovered where there's a pulsar going around a neutron star, and it's losing energy, and you can measure how it's losing energy. So the energy loss is predicted exactly by the emission of gravitational waves from this system. So we believe gravitational waves exist, and we've got this system where it looks like gravitational waves must be being emitted from this system, but no one has ever seen those gravitational waves.
It's just that gravitational wave emission is predicted by general relativity, and it matches the observations perfectly. So
yep.
That explains what we see. How actually do we measure this loss of energy in the pulsar system?
Basically, you study the orbit of the... So you can work out the orbital period and all the other Keplerian parameters of this system, and you notice that the orbital period is changing as you observe it over 20 years or so. And how that's changing is predicted exactly by by this emission of gravitational waves.
So we know the gravitational waves are being emitted. We can't directly detect them.
Correct. So people have been looking for gravitational waves since about the 1960s. So far, nobody has found them.
So hopefully pulsar timing arrays will be the first detection of gravitational waves.
It's a little bit of a competition, but yep, that's what it could well be.
You do see yourself in competition with the likes of LIGO and LISA?
Yes, so there's two things. There's always a competition to make the first detection. If we can improve our timing a little bit, we reckon on a timescale of 5 to 10 years, we should be able to make a detection. It's unlikely that LISA will even be flying on that sort of timescale, so they're not likely to make the first detection. LIGO is going through an enhancement at the moment, which means there's a possibility on a timescale of 3 to 5 years it might make a detection. But advanced LIGO, which is almost guaranteed, is probably not until another 5 years after that, so 10 years or so from now. So we're all around the same sort of timescale for when we might make a detection.
But you're talking about doing research with data in hand. I mean, you've done these observations of these pulsars up until now with some degree of accuracy that you could use for this research. So you've got all the data. We've got some data, let's say, up to now, and now you're making some predictions on how much more data you will need to rule out various scenarios for gravitational waves, yes?
That's correct. Mm. So at the moment, we haven't made a detection, but we've certainly said that if there was a gravitational wave background that was very, very strong, we would have seen it. We haven't seen it, so we can rule out some models of gravitational waves.
Great. Well, we look forward to more results. Thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you.